More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. In his new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us, education writer Paul Tough dismantles the myth of college as a pure meritocracy. Instead, he finds that higher education in the United States reinforces class and racial inequalities. He tells the story with research and data, but also through the personal experiences of young people. Tough spoke with WUWM's education reporter Emily Files, beginning with a story of one of the students featured in his book, Yvonne Martinez, a first-generation student at the University of Texas in Austin. Martinez didn't have high test scores, but she was still admitted to the elite university. Tough explains how UT Austin's admission system opens the door for students like Martinez in a way that other flagship universities don't.
So most states, their flagship institutions are actually becoming more and more like selective private institutions. Test scores are becoming more and more important at most flagships. But the University of Texas in Austin is different because 20 years ago, the Texas legislature passed this law called the top 10% rule that is now actually more like the top 6%. So if you are a student in high school anywhere in Texas and you're in the top 6% of your class by GPA, you are automatically admitted to UT Austin. And so you get this class that shows up each fall in Austin that is very different than the classes at other flagships. They're much more diverse because you have the top 6% from, you know, a high school in suburban Dallas, but you also have the top 6% from schools in the Rio Grande Valley, where almost everyone is Latino or Latina, from ranching communities, from inner city neighborhoods. So it creates a much more diverse class. And it also means that they don't look at standardized test scores. They can't. They have to admit students who are in the top 6% by GPA alone. So Yvonne was a perfect example of this, right? She had an unbelievable GPA right at the top of her class, but her ACT score was a 22, which is above average, but only a little bit above average and not the kind of score you see in most highly selective flagships like UT.
So what was playing out at UT Austin was the opposite of what had been happening at other elite universities around the country, or what has been happening. You write about how admissions at public flagship institutions have trended towards seeking out more wealthy and out-of-state students. So tell me more about the pressures that have led to that.
Mostly the pressures are just money. So state governments in, I think, almost every state in the country have cut their higher education budgets by 15 or 20% just since 2001. Part of it had to do with the recession in 2008, but it was happening before that. And then when the recovery came, funding didn't return. And so we have really changed the way we finance public higher education in this country. It's not very public anymore. We are putting more and more of the burden on individual students and individual families, which means tuition is going up, debt is going up, and the public investment is going down.
It reminded me of a story that I did recently about the Promise Program at UW-Madison. You've probably heard about these free tuition Promise Programs. And a listener asked us, why doesn't UW-Milwaukee have a Promise Program? And administrators there pointed to the difference in the number of Pell-eligible students who would qualify for this type of program. It's about a third of students at UW-Milwaukee are Pell-eligible. At UW-Madison, it's about 14%.
Yes. I mean, the thing to remember about Pell eligibility is you don't have to be very low income. Like, about half of high school graduates would be eligible for a Pell grant if they went right on to college. And so, yeah, so flagships like UW-Madison, a lot of them have Pell percentages down in the low teens. So 14% is not out of the ordinary at all. And in lots of cases, the Pell percentages at those flagship institutions are lower than at some private institutions that are similarly selective. So in other words, these public institutions just aren't doing the job that they were founded to do, which is to educate a broad swath of the students with the most potential in that state.
Yeah, that was something new for me. Your description of the Pell eligibility, it's not as simple as saying those are low-income students. And you talk about how elite universities are sometimes disproportionately accepting students who are at the higher range of Pell eligibility, meaning their family income is just below the cutoff. Mm-hmm. So can you talk more about that and how it relates to the story of Kiki Gilbert at Princeton University?
Sure. So that study, the study about the Pell cutoff, it was done by a couple of economists, Carolyn Hawksby and Sarah Turner, and just came out earlier this year. And it really does sort of stoke the conspiracy-minded theorizing in some of us because, yeah, what they were able to look at precise incomes for different students who had applied to certain colleges, and they saw that a lot of institutions feel like they don't want people like us to say like, oh, your Pell percentage is so low. So they try to get the Pell percentage as high as possible to give at least the impression that they're educating a really broad range of students. And so if you are just below the Pell cutoff, as rich as you can be and still be eligible for a Pell grant, you're much more likely to be accepted either than students who are genuinely low income or than students who are just above the Pell cutoff. You know, generally, most of the students who are admitted to these institutions are from affluent families, from the top economic quintile. But when they're looking for lower income students, that's exactly where they look, just below the Pell cutoff.
So Kiki Gilbert was a low-income African-American student at Princeton University. Not sure she's still a student there.
She is. She's a junior now, yeah.
Great. But when she arrived there, she was thinking that there would be at least some students who had similar backgrounds to her. But she realized the longer she was there that the kind of poverty that she came from was not common at all among the students at Princeton.
Yeah. So Kiki Gilbert was one of the most remarkable students who I met. I met her when she was just finished with her junior year in high school. And so she's an African-American student. She was living in Charlotte when I met her, Charlotte, North Carolina, and from a really low-income family with a pretty chaotic history and in living in generational poverty in the United States. Mostly what she found was that the way that Princeton put together its class, there was very little room for students like her. I mean, first of all, most Princeton students are affluent. You know, almost three quarters are from the top income quintile. And that when they were admitting low-income students, it was mostly either sort of higher-income, low-income students, students who were very close to that Pell cutoff, or it was or they were more likely to be white or Latino low-income students, that the African-American students who were there were more likely to be from professional families or private schools or the children of recent immigrants from Africa or the Caribbean or all three of those.
So how much does that have to do with the standardized test scores, and how does that affect the students that colleges are accepting?
Yeah, it has something to do with standardized test scores. So, you know, so the SAT and the ACT, there's a big debate about how useful they are in predicting which students will do well in college. But one thing that's clear about them is that your SAT and your ACT score, it correlates strongly with your family background. They are a really good predictor of how much money your family has. And so when institutions put a lot of emphasis on SAT and ACT scores in admissions, it makes it much more likely that they're going to admit a really affluent class. There's this economist, Raj Chetty, who, along with some colleagues, did a report called the Mobility Report Cards paper, which found that those Ivy League colleges have very few students from the lowest economic quintile, from, you know, with the bottom fifth of family incomes. Only about 2 or 3% of the student body was from that bottom quintile. Why that isn't changing, I feel like it is all the kind of incentives in the system are pushing those institutions toward admitting more white and wealthy students. For the first one being that they can pay tuition. The test scores is part of it. There are so many elements in the system that steer institutions toward admitting more and more high-income students.
That research from Raj Chetty about the economic diversity at these elite institutions, the other piece of that that makes it even more depressing is that the Ivy League schools, the most elite schools, are the most powerful drivers of economic mobility for low-income students.
Yeah, it is the real paradox. I mean, certainly in Raj Chetty's work, but just in all of my reporting, that, you know, higher education still is this great vehicle for social mobility for individual students. When a young person like Kiki Gilbert, again, came from very difficult circumstances, no money in her family at all. The fact that she is now at Princeton and going to graduate in a year means she is highly likely to have a really financially successful life. The problem is there are just so few of those students. And most low-income students, I mean most American college students in general, but certainly most low-income students are going to public universities. Low-income students tend more often to go to community colleges and regional public universities that have the lowest graduation rates. When Akiki Gilbert manages to get to Princeton, their options are great, but very few of them do.
More colleges are becoming test optional, meaning students don't have to submit their SAT or ACT test scores. Marquette University here in Milwaukee recently joined the growing number of institutions that are going test optional. Is that a solution to the inequities that are perpetuated by this reliance on standardized tests to rank colleges in terms of how elite they are?
Well, it might be a solution. I don't think it's the solution. I mean, I think that there are lots of reasons that institutions choose to do that. I feel like the case for considering test scores is that test scores give a small amount more certainty about whether a student is going to succeed at your institution than just looking at their GPA alone. What admissions people who choose to go test optional say is that additional amount of confidence in how well a student will do is outweighed by the inequity that comes along with considering a data point that correlates so strongly with family income. And so I think when you go test optional, it gives you an opportunity to consider a certain type of students like Yvonne Martinez, the UT student we were talking about before, who have great GPAs and lower test scores. It is not a magic bullet. There are still so many incentives in the system that incline institutions to admit more rich kids and fewer poor kids, that going test optional alone doesn't always make a big change in the socioeconomic diversity of a school.
So the reality of higher education being so skewed towards the wealthy and well-connected is pretty discouraging. What gives you the most hope in your reporting and writing of this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two things. One is that I feel like there are more institutions that are at least trying, or at least saying that they're trying to admit a more diverse class. I feel like there is this new sort of public pressure, which I hope the public will keep up on institutions to bring genuine diversity to more and more campuses. And then I think there's also this change that's happening on many campuses about the responsibility of institutions to help students graduate. So the place where I saw this most vividly in my reporting was at the University of Texas in Austin. Over the past 7 or 8 years, they put in a variety of new supports for students, a summer program for first-generation students before freshman year, a freshman sort of learning community that gave especially low-income first-generation students a sense of connection to each other and to the campus, internships and mentoring and counseling. And all of those supports made a huge difference in how students in general did at UT, whether their graduation rates went up by 20 points in just a few years. But they especially went up for those low-income, first-generation, lower-scoring students. What UT shows is if you do sort of just kind of a basic sense of like welcome and making students feel like they belong and recognizing that being a first-generation student or a low-income student comes with additional challenges, if you recognize that and if you put those sorts of supports in place, actually those students are going to succeed at the same level as their higher scoring peers. And so I think you can put those two changes together to create a pretty hopeful picture that if institutions decide to make admissions less dependent on test scores and more focused on real socioeconomic diversity, and at the same time they're offering some kind of pretty basic supports for the first generation and low-income students, you can not only have a more diverse class, you can have a more successful class. And when that happens, higher education goes back to doing the job that we established it to do, which is being an engine of social mobility, being the force that can really help low-income students move into the middle class and middle-class students move into affluence.
Paul Tough is the author of the new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. He spoke with WUWM's education reporter, Emily Files.